The Guardian.
If you've got a mobile business, you need an easy way to take multiple payment types with one integration. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more. Braintree also has quick, knowledgeable developer support, so there's help whenever you need it. The Braintree V.0 SDK. One snippet of code and you're all set up and ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. To find out more and for your first £30,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly.
Hello, I'm Ollie Mann and this is Tech Weekly. Next Tuesday is the 5th birthday of Instagram. The picture-sharing social network launched on October the 6th, 2010, and now attracts 200 million logins every day and more than 300 million users. Now part of Facebook, the company was started by Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger. Mike was born in Brazil, studied at Stanford, and went on to work for a couple of Silicon Valley startups until he discovered that photos could be square and then change the internet forever, or something like that. We'll find out because I've blagged into Instagram HQ here in Menlo Park, California, for an exclusive chat with Mike to look back over the past 5 years and also look forward into the future and what might be next for this game-changing company. Hold it, snap bang, wallet, what a picture. And then put it in a white border. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Mike Krieger, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
It's good to be here because I am an Instagram HQ, which is very exciting. We're in an impossibly funky, would you call this a boardroom? I bet you've got a cool name for it, breakout room.
This is like where we have most of our meetings. We bring our guests. It's the most Instagrammy room in the building.
Looking around this most Instagrammy room, there's lots of images on the wall. Are these pictures that were taken on Instagram and uploaded by ordinary users?
Yeah, most of them are. And then we also have a table that has the very first photo uploaded on Instagram, which is apropos of our 5th birthday, which is a photo of a dog in Mexico that my co-founder took when he was off there. We're actually working on our first filters, and I was back in California working on our first app. So there's some history in this room for sure.
So that photo that I'm looking at, which, as you say, is now a sort of Perspex coffee table, when that photo was taken, I guess it wasn't even known that it was an Instagram photo.
No, it wasn't. It was called Codename at the time because we hadn't come up with any better name for it. We decided just to call it that.
I mean, it kind of makes sense with these stories to start at the beginning. But with you, I kind of feel like in a way we should start with your Instagram feed because this room is underlining this fact. Now, the last photo that you posted at the time of recording was an image which was the second in a series of two. With a hashtag, was it Cats on Modern Staircases?
Cats on Modern Staircases, my ongoing photo project of two photos.
Yeah. So, and it's the same staircase, isn't it?
But it's the same staircase. We just did a remodel, so we moved back in actually Friday, and I was sitting there, and I said, oh, the cat is back, and she's in the exact same position as she was. I think it was a year and a half exactly. So I took a photo, and you know, it's fun that not a single person had come up with that hashtag in the intervening year and a half. So I still retain sole control over hashtag cats on modern staircases.
It seems to me that encapsulates that one random image, you know, just happens to be the most recent one you've put up. A lot of the ways that people are using your service now, I mean, cats, obviously, interiors as well. And that element of sharing something that in the past used to be private. I mean, that would be a joke that you and your partner would see and say, oh, our cat's on the staircase again. It's not something you'd ever have thought 5 years ago you would be able to share with the world.
Right. And I think textually it would have been quite boring, too. Like if I put on Facebook, hey, there's my cat's on the stair again. People are like, you know, cool story. But they wouldn't actually, it's something about the visual. And, you know, and I looked at that moment, not to overanalyze it, but, you know, it looks nice. You know, our stair looks especially nice now. I wanted to take a photo of it. And, you know, there's that memory in there as well, kind of like a, not nostalgia, but like a little throwback to something that just happened a couple of years ago now.
How considered are your images on Instagram when you upload them? Because, you know, a lot of people think twice before they think, oh, is this a cliche? Is this interesting enough?
Mine have become more and more considered. It's been interesting with all this 5th birthday stuff to go back. And I always used to post like 8 times a day, and not all of them were winners. It was a lot. Kevin likes to make fun of my early photography of food. He's like, you would get up really close to the food at the point it was unrecognizable as anything you'd ever want to eat. And then we'd put like a really over the top, you know, effect on top of it. So It's become a lot more considered. But actually, one thing that's changed recently is we launched Non-Square, which, you know, if you think of Instagram as Square Photos, is crazy. If you think of Instagram as visual communication, it makes sense. And once we did that, I realized video in widescreen is so much more fun to shoot and share.
And video as well. Do you think ultimately that is, and we will go back to the beginning in just a second before we fast forward to the end, but do you think that is the future? Do you think possibly there's even a time where video will overtake photo in terms of its shareability?
It's really funny. When we launched video, this was in 2013, I believe, is when we launched video. And when we were working on it, we said, all right, like, what do we think the actual proportions are going to be once we're out? And also, what would be okay? Or like, what would you expect? And we didn't really know. And to this day, a lot more people share photos and video than videos. I think that that's natural. Videos, you're moving, you know, it's like taking, you know, 30 photos a second, and they all have to be pretty good, or at least on average, interesting enough. And I think that there's something really beautiful about being able to, like, reduce a moment to something that's photographic, which is in some ways how we remember a lot of things.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning then, because initially, when Instagram had that photo that was on the coffee table uploaded into Project Code or whatever it was called, when it eventually got a name, it was called Bourbon. Is that right? B-U-R-B-N.
This was all kind of happening at the same time. So we had a project called Bourbon, which, contrary to popular belief, is not because we just really loved bourbon, although we've come to appreciate bourbon since then. Pro tip, if you name your company after an alcohol, you will then receive that alcohol as a gift for the rest of your life.
That's a brilliant tip.
It's, there you go. You should call your podcast the name your favorite spirit, and then yeah, you'll get gifts forever.
Actually, I did know that because I once made a show for Malibu, and they sent me cases of it. And I'll tell you what, there is only so much Malibu one grown man can drink. That's a drink that's essentially for 15-year-old girls. Anyway, sorry, yes, continue.
And so we're working on Bourbon, and it started life as, and this is a little known fact, as sort of a mafia wars in the real world. Do you remember Mafia Wars? It was kind of, you could, it's like a saloon speakeasy game, and you would be like, I want to take over the saloon and manage it and run, you know, bootleg stuff. And we're kind of setting out to build that in the real world. And Kevin was actually before he really even brought me on. And
so a location-based app, but with a kind of gamified element.
Exactly, except he never got to the gamified part. So we built the location-based part where you could move or check into places and add photos. And that in itself was actually compelling enough to get, you know, about 1,000 people using it, including me, which is how we first connected. And I was like, this is great. I actually want to, you know, jump ship from where I was and join you and build this thing as your co-founder. And the problem was those 1,000 users were as many as we'd ever get, because the product was very complicated, and you know, 2013 was the year of video, 2010 was the year of the check-in, right? So Gowalla, Foursquare, Looped, you name it, were out there. And having yet another one, which its main differentiation was that it was built in HTML5, meaning it ran in your browser instead of running as an app, which arguably wasn't even an advantage, was not compelling enough. So we took a lot of what we'd learned there, and then as this photo of the dog was being taken, we were in the middle of evolving it from being very general to being very specifically about visual moments, to not requiring location but making it optional, and to really focusing on making that amazing and throwing away 90% of the craft.
That's really interesting that you say that something at that time that was a game and location-based probably wouldn't have an audience beyond Silicon Valley. Because something that I've noticed just in the few days that I've been here, actually, is this is a town where Yahoo inexplicably have taken out massive billboards everywhere that aren't promoting a particular thing, just their brand. This is a town where you go to the supermarket and there's loads of Tesla parking bay so you can charge your car. Everyone's using Uber, and I know that that happens all around the world, but it's really happening here. I get the impression that people possibly who live around here sort of slightly lose touch with the fact that their products have to sell in places where they need to be explained.
I like to say in San Francisco, you live in the future that will never happen. So like you, there's a lot of companies out there that have raised capital and are trying things out, and some of them will work and then become international. I think Uber and Lyft are great examples. And some of them you're like, it cannot be sustainable to like deliver me cupcakes within 5 minutes via tricycle, you know, which is an extreme version of some of the things out there. But, you know, like you'll see a lot of those. And I love it living in San Francisco because you get to try these things out and see how they, you know, change your life or they don't. And some of the ones you really hope take off because they actually become part of your life. And then some of them are kind of fun to use for a year and then be like, well, that was nice while it lasted. But yeah, I think you're right that it is hard to keep that perspective when you're surrounded by a bunch of early adopters who will try your product at least once, and B, other companies that seemingly have other ideas that are similar to the ones that you're working on. Then one of the things I was really happy with Instagram when we finally did launch is very early, we had an international audience. So we grew in Japan within the first week. We had people kind of started taking off in Japan. And that's when I knew we hadn't created just a Bay Area, San Francisco thing. We had something that had legs internationally.
Can you give an example of something that was a great idea or felt like a great idea and then something
Yeah, we built prototyped on paper and threw away an entire stickers on your photo feature in one day. So the place we were was called Pier 38. It was a pier on the water in San Francisco. And across the street was this little cafe with an outdoor area. And that's where we would go and sketch. And there was a day we're like, hey, like, we heard like stickers are really big in Japan and other countries. Like, why don't we like see what that would mean with Instagram? And we got really excited about it. We could sell them. And then at the end, we're like, man, this like doesn't fit. And I'm so happy. Like, throwing away a piece of paper, or probably like 10 pieces of paper at that point, versus weeks and weeks and weeks of code is definitely the way to do it. So as much as we could in those early days, we would feel things out using these just very quick paper sketches, and then we'd jump in. And to this day, like when we ask our designers to come up with interesting mocks for something, we try to keep them at wireframe level for as long as possible, because again, then the cost of throwing things away is lower than if you're like, oh, but this mock is perfect. It's basically built. Come on. You know, it might not be the right product.
Do you think it's necessary to have a complete understanding of the ones and the zeros as well as the aesthetics? Or is it possible to be the leader of a company like that with just a big idea?
I think we were an interesting co-founding pair because both of us have a little bit of both of that side. So Kevin studied management science and engineering, and I studied symbolic systems, which is this sort of cognitive science meets computer science degree. But none of us were strict computer scientists. And in fact, we've hired a team of sort of engineers that are far better at going deep in that stuff than either of us ever were. But I think what we brought to the table is I think the healthy balance between you can do enough to, you know, prove out that there's at least something there and then start building the team around that. But we also like understood why we were building what we were building and how to build something that people would like. So that's the balance I would strive for. It's less about being the world's greatest engineer and like understanding, you know, Objective-C better than any other engineer. You just need to get to the point where you can show your idea to enough people where you're getting validation, you might get early users, and you might be building that out.
Because there's a bit of a cliche, isn't there, around especially Silicon Valley, your CEOs and CTOs, that, you know, they don't have social skills, that they're a bit autistic, and I'm sure a lot of them are somewhere on the scale. But, you know, there's a sense that they lack the understanding to be able to approach things in a human way. And it seems to me it wouldn't be possible to build a successful company if that really was the case.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I learned so much getting out there and just showing people what we were working on. We had this thing called the bar exam, which was not legal at all. It was just we would go to the bar and we would show the people in the bar, random people, what we were working on. And if they were interested, we could successfully explain what we were working on in a 3-minute window that you might have with a stranger at the bar before they ran away.
Had you been drinking at this point?
Probably, yeah. Bourbon, for example, failed the bar exam. We'd be like, it's a check-in app where you can move to places and get points and meet your friends and you can make plant. And it's like, they're gone. Instagram, it's like, hey, you're sharing your life on the go and we make your photos look awesome.
Yeah, I'm in. So is that why, do you think, when you did launch, October the 6th, 2010, you had, I think, 25,000 users.
Right.
On day one. Could you have anticipated anything like that?
Well, I'm usually the, you call it pessimist or realist or just the worrier in our co-founding pair, and Kevin is the optimist. And the night before, we had made a bet, and he's like, how many people do you think are going to sign up the first day? He said 2,500. And something about it, I was like, I'm going to go big. I'm going to say 25,000, and I was right on the nose.
Wow.
So my one moment of like, yes, this thing is going to work. And then that was followed by like, you know, months of like anguish, like, is it still going to work? Is it going to keep growing? You know. But no,
did
it's
hard to. Did you have funding at that point, or was it still the two of you?
We had funding, but not very much. And I'm Brazilian, so the funding was mostly used to like get my visa. Is effectively what we used the funding for. We'd spent so little money by the time we launched. We subsisted on the daily special sandwich across the street at that same place. The way we grew, past the initial spark, because that initial press bump will get you some attention, but it doesn't lead to retention over time, and it won't lead to viral growth. It was that people liked the way things came out when they used Instagram, and they wanted to share that with people because it made them look at them like, hey, I took this great photo of something and I'm expressing myself. And conversely, their friends would say, how did you do that? That looks really interesting. That looks opinionated. It doesn't look like every other photo. And that conversation, more than anything, I think is what really kicked off growth, is that people wanted to find out how other folks were making interesting looking photos.
And so it was the filters, you think, was probably the big sell. I mean, that would tally with how I experienced it in real life. People talking about it was through filtering. But there were other apps that did photo filters. It's just to share it anywhere was quite complicated. And what you did is made it all one or or two tabs.
Right. It's the combination, I think, of the filters, which we spent a lot of time making as good as we could. And I think they've gotten a lot better since then, too, as we've tried to pare them down and make them more minimal. But also the fact that we tried to make every single interaction great. We chose to cut dozens of features. Bourbon, the product we were working on before, actually had video. So we had video in a product in 2010, but it wasn't going to work that well, you know, from day one in Instagram. So we cut it, and we cut a bunch of other things. And instead of like the core flow of, I have a photo, I want to take it, I want to put a filter on it, I want to share it, needs to be, you know, 10 tabs basically. And we got it down to that. And every screen we would look at and say like, are people going to look at this and understand like the most obvious thing they need to do on the next step? And just doing that made people able, it lowered the barrier for people to share. When we identified 2010, what sucks basically about mobile photography, it's they look not great. You know, the state of the art back then was the iPhone 3G, 3GS. You know, things have come a long way since then.
So with those kind of numbers, people being attracted to what you were doing, inevitably, you know, talk of a sale couldn't have been too far from your mind. And eventually you sold to Facebook for $1 billion, $300 million in cash, the rest in Facebook stock. And that was only 18 months after your launch at double the valuation that at the time you were using to raise funds. I imagine that must have slightly knocked you for six. I mean, you knew you had a hot property, right? But you presumably didn't expect Mark Zuckerberg to come along and say, well, here's double.
Right. And, you know, our full intention in raising the round right before was, hey, we're setting the course and, you know, we kind of know what the next couple of years need to look like product-wise. We know we need to start building a business. We knew we needed to scale the team. We were six engineers at the time, which was tiny. Mm-hmm. So to be able to go from that to six, it's ridiculous. unfortunately, it's used as a model nowadays. People are like, yeah, I tell my engineers, Instagram only had six people. Why can't you do it? I'm like, that's not the healthy way of looking at the situation. We were really underwater. But, you know, we were tiny and we knew we had to build the company, build the monetization product and, you know, keep expanding. And what just made sense in coming down here is that Facebook was able to help us accelerate in every single one of those. And the sort of framework around it, which was keeping us as an independent, you know, team and an independent product, has really played out. So you never know, but it really actually did work out in that
sense. Well, yeah. And I mean, you've now been part of Facebook for longer than you weren't.
Right.
But at the time when you made that decision, it still must have felt a little bit precarious. I mean, I remember in the press, people were almost looking for examples of, oh, they've made the wrong decision. There was a lot of stuff about your terms of use and stuff like that was in the news, wasn't it, immediately after Facebook bought you. Were you concerned that image-wise, it might not be the best move?
Yeah, and I think there's always that concern of, like, how are things going to change? Are they going to be different? And in ensuing years, I've seen that with other companies and been very sympathetic. Like, I remember that press. It's like, it's a natural question to ask, which is, well, something's going to change. It's impossible that nothing has changed. Is it going to change for the better or for worse or for different? Or, and I think what kind of gave me the certainty at the time was, look, in the end, like, the proof is going to be in the pudding. And if we keep doing what we're doing and we keep the product simple and make it great and continue on that track, then eventually people will not, you know, will forget that or will get over that. And I think that's what we've tried to do over the last 3 years.
And obviously your product has a lot of symbiosis with what Facebook were trying to do at the time. Do you think there was an element that maybe they saw you as a threat as well? You were attracting a younger audience at a time when Facebook, though massive, was attracting older people.
I think having a different network and being sort of follow first instead of friending, I think, you know, I put myself in their shoes. They're like, huh, this is in our space, but like not exactly what we're doing. So, and it's hard for them to do that within Facebook, right? Like a company that's based so much on your friends and, you know, you can follow pages, but that's really the core thing is your friends. To see a almost like 90 degree rotation on that thing, which is, what if you followed things and you didn't have to follow back? And that's how you built the network. So I think that was the sweet spot of in the space so that it becomes, you know, you call it threatening or just within that space, but different enough that it was additive to bring it on.
Because it seems to me that that's the strategy they've been following ever since with purchases of WhatsApp, for example.
Sure.
For more money as well. I mean, it seems like they've now got this whole world of complementary services that at certain times look like they might be eclipsing them. What's the relationship like with Facebook and your staff going between the two?
Well, we had very little staff, which was the easy part was we came in here and, you know, we were about 16 people total. So six engineers, 16 total. And very early on, you know, we started meeting with folks who were interested in moving over. But it was more of a trickle than a flood, which I think was healthy. So I think we ended the year at, you know, 29 people. So it wasn't like we doubled overnight. And, you know, kind of kept that cadence going since then. But one of the things that made it work, people often are like, what can we learn from this acquisition for other ones? Because they often don't work well. And I think the biggest thing was the message from Mark down to, you know, every engineer was heard, which was, hey, leave these guys alone, and if they want help, help them. And that was it. It wasn't, hey, figure out, like, you know, what efficiencies we can get by, like, migrating their infrastructure tomorrow, or, hey, like, let's figure out how to use this in this product. It was like, look, they're doing the reconnecting to the reason that we were interesting to them in the first place, which is we had a successful product, and our team was able to execute at a really high level despite being tiny, and make that successful and grow it over time instead of trying to come in and make us more like them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you can almost feel that just walking around the campus, actually. I've only been here for a short time, but it feels like an independent label within a studio system, if you like. It doesn't feel like you're absolutely symbiotic with Facebook.
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting part is over time, the underlying bits have become a lot more integrated. So we moved all of our infrastructure from Amazon EC2 into the Facebook data centers. And from an end user perspective, that didn't change anything. From our perspective, it made a big difference. We could hook into a lot of their measurement systems. We could better fight spam, all the stuff that we were able to do once we were in there. And I like those kinds of changes where to an end user, it's just like, oh, this product is just better. And it makes our lives as engineers and team members easier.
Right. I want to talk to you about some of your favorite users, because I imagine you spend a lot of time browsing Instagram. Who do you think is really using it in an interesting way or a way that challenges your expectations?
Ooh, and I'll bucket this because I think there's different areas. So I'll start with like maybe the most obvious Instagram-y thing, which is dogs. I have a Bernese Mountain Dog, and I have discovered a Bernese Mountain Dog community through Instagram. There are hundreds of them, and they all have their own accounts. So, I mean, I use that mostly as a way of illustrating, like, even within pets, like, people really, like, I think they spend time curating their accounts. Some of them become even sort of well-known and endorsed by brands. It's a funny, like, kind of sub-world over there that I find pretty interesting. NASA, on the completely other end of the spectrum, I think has an incredible account. So
they've got some good content for nice photos.
They do. But, you know, you could also imagine, like, them just totally botching it. But instead, we launched Nonsquare, I guess it was just 2 weeks ago. And the next day they had just these incredible videos that were, you know, tall videos, right? They were portrait on flying through space, and I was just like, this is why we built this. This is amazing. So I think NASA does a great job. All the, like, natural sort of travel ones I feel like are often very compelling. Like National Geographic was, I remember when we were getting started, we're like, wouldn't it be amazing if National Geographic were on? And then, like, now they're on, and that's really, really fun. I do follow, like, some, what we call our, like, celebrity accounts, you know. Actually, we had Carly Kloss talk to us a little about some of her, like, coding initiatives that she's been working on. And I think her account does a great job of showing her sort of full life, but also, like, talking about the things that really matter to her, like teaching girls to code, for example. I feel like this is just an exhaustive list. But what I like is the diversity of, like, you know, I'll open up my Instagram feed and I'll scroll through, you know, a Bernese Mountain Dog. And then one of my best friends might be, you know, doing something interesting, like making pizza. And then the next photo is, you know, space. And then the next photo might be, like, you know, a Brazilian, like Neymar, posting a photo. So, like, that kind of, like, switch. For some reason, like, with Instagram, it works together. And it's, like, something about, like, the constraints of the platform where it all comes together. And, like, your feed can be very diverse but still compelling in itself.
It's also changed, it seems to me, the kind of experiences people want. Maybe it's made people feel a bit more aspirational in terms of the kind of food they want to order and the kind of holidays they want to book.
I like saying that we are probably responsible for at least some percentage of Iceland's tourism GDP. I know I went to Iceland mostly because of Instagram. My friend Rodrigo just went to Iceland, and a lot of people are like, oh yeah, you know, I saw those photos on Instagram and they looked amazing. So I decided to travel to Iceland. Like, you know, in my spare time, want to run some data to see if there's any at all bearing in reality for this. But yeah, I think it can be. We find that people just get inspired by seeing sometimes distant places, sometimes new places in your city as well. San Francisco, one of the other things that we are lucky to have is a lot of new restaurants pop up all the time. And I'll often find out about them because one of my friends will go. And then, you know, you tap the location tag and all of a sudden you basically have their menu. You have people experiencing the dining. You can see what the dress code is like. You can see what people get excited about. So that's my hope. My hope is, like, the positive spin is, like, we end up creating sort of an aspiration or a sort of a desire to explore or try something new.
Yeah, I suppose the negative spin would be there's an anxiety then that's caused by people having to live a certain kind of lifestyle, or restaurants feeling that the most important thing is the way the food looks, not how it tastes.
Right. Yeah, and we were just talking about, like, do you optimize for Instagrammability of your food or deliciousness, and is there a trade-off there? I feel like the good side of it is the one I mostly see expressed, which is people will be like, oh yeah, like I found this on Instagram, it's very exciting. I've like connected with this new artist.
And when it comes to that feeling of getting as many clicks as possible, as many hearts as possible, some people say the most effective way to use Instagram is actually to take photos with a camera, not a mobile phone camera. In fact, The Guardian, when I was sent here, said, take some pictures with a proper camera, don't use your phone. I wonder how you feel about that, because obviously they found their experience is the more beautiful the photo, and that means probably, you know, the most high quality the photo, it's going to get more clicks. But obviously that in a way runs counter to the spirit of what you're intending to do, which is take a snap and enhance it.
It's a good question. We, for example, only allow uploading from your mobile phone. So even if you are going to use a DSLR, like, you're choosing to do it. It's not the default. It's like, oh, I had those photos from last weekend, so I'm going to throw them on the website, you know, using like a desktop uploader sort of thing. I think a lot about in product design, the defaults and sort of the expectations that you set through the design dictate the behavior on the platform. So, you know, even though we allow non-square, we default to square. And that's saying like, hey, most of the photos are going to be square. And it's true, the vast majority remain square. But that photo, you're like, ah, oh, this is so annoying. I wanted to show this mountain and I'm only get half of it. Now you can share more of it without having to resort to another app. So the first good news is that every year that goes by, our mobile cameras are getting incredibly good. So that gap is closing really, really quickly. But what I mostly care about with Instagram is that it feels timely. Like, it's not like all, yeah, these are my vacation photos from a month ago. Obviously, this throwback Thursday, but the overall platform is timely and authentic. So it's not, hey, like, this, I'm posting this on my account, but it's really, you know, my manager took this of me if they're a celebrity. It's, I'm interested in this and I wanted to share this. And ultimately, if those two are true, whether it got captured on, you know, a fancy Nikon or your iPhone or Android, like, that doesn't matter.
From that point of view, it's a bit unfair that Twitter gets the reputation for being the one that breaks the news. You know, the Arab Spring was called the Twitter Revolution and all the rest, sometimes the Facebook Revolution. People don't think of Instagram as a place where you'd put a breaking news photo.
Yeah, and I think that's starting to change. So we launched Trending just 3 months ago, and we've started to see journalists turn to Instagram or say, hey, there's something going on in the world. You can now search by place and you can search by tag more easily. And I've seen more and more photos get surfaced now in articles that are, oh, like, that came from Instagram. And I think that kind of connection, I think, will work on more over time because it's there. You know, we have 80 plus million photos getting uploaded every day, and some of them are from really timely, important things. We just need to do a better job of making sure those are findable.
Okay. And finally, then, the future. What is the biggest challenge that you have to overcome? What do you think Instagram's going to look like In another five years.
So I think there's a few different ones that I get excited about. One is we have now, you know, if you do 80 million photos a day and you extend it over a long enough time, we have a lot of stuff on there. And right now people get exposed to a really narrow slice. So one of the things we've been building over the last couple of years is a really good data team who use machine learning and things like that to say, what are the best photos for you? You know, and we try to surface them and explore, and we've gotten better at that over time and saying, hey, we think this person is really interested in these things and these are the kinds of photos that they should be interested in. So helping you have like an endless deep experience with them inside Instagram, even when you're done with your feed, I get really excited about that part. And I get really excited about Instagram Direct. So we just launched second version of Instagram Direct. We revamped quite a bit of it, but in general, what that product wants to be, it doesn't want to be, you know, competing with Messenger or WhatsApp or iMessage or any one of these things, because those use cases are really well solved. We want to help you share visual moments really quickly that are more private with other people. And there's lots of fun ideas we have around how to make that really instantaneous and really fun and simple. So those are just two of them. But I wake up every morning, I'm like, we need like twice the number of people. We need to like move twice as fast. There's so much we want to do. And that's like what keeps me really excited here too.
So more shareable with private people, but not necessarily more shareable like a retweet. I've noticed it is a little bit harder on Instagram to just reblog something or regram something in the language.
Which, yeah, actually the funny, we built that basically before we launched and we scrapped it because we were worried it would clutter people's feeds, especially when each photo takes up so much room. One thing we just added this week is the ability to reshare privately to people. So if you find something great, you know, this little arrow thing, you tap that, you can choose a user and that will go straight to them. Whether we allow something more public like that, like a public reshare option, is something that we think about a lot. Just how can you say, I will like this and I think all the people who follow me want to see it, but not make it, you know, crowd out other people's real content in their feed. It's a tricky balance.
Okay, well, you don't need good luck from me for the next 5 years, but anyway, good luck. Mike Krieger, thank you very much for joining me. If people want to find out more about your website, where can they find it? I'm just joking.
INS.
This has been Tech Weekly at Instagram for their fifth birthday. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer is Alana Chance. We'll see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.